Our guest speaker this morning, Dan or Danny Unruh, may be new to some of you, but I've known Dan for many years, going all the way back to my days in Winnipeg. Just a couple of things about Dan. Dan's been a longtime pastor and also an author. You'll hear him probably share a few stories this morning. He's spent a lot of time traveling in many parts of the world, especially also spent time in the Holy Land, and I thought it would be great to have someone come and share with us. Dan also works part-time with Mennonite Central Committee, and he's going to share a little bit about that. But thank you very much, Dan, for coming. Glad you're here.
Morning. Drove all the way from Richmond this morning. It's cold here in the north. Dave set me up a little bit. I'm known as a storyteller, preacher, and I'm very awed, I'm told, by many people in that I have made friends with conflict. I actually like conflict in most cases. And as a pastor for 30 years, that meant being somewhat friendly with conflict. That created a fair bit. And so people often came at me really sharply. At the Fraser View Church in Richmond, where I pastored for almost 21 years, I had this wonderful, wonderful elderly woman who was tough. Her name was Anne. And she would take me on. She walked through the back door of the church one weekday morning, and when I opened the door for her, she said, "You know, on Sunday when I left, Pastor, I was so angry I could just spit." And I said, "Oh, what did I do now?" She said, "Well, 6 years. You've been here 6 years. Haven't heard a sermon yet, just a bunch of stories." And I said, "Well, Aunt Annie," and Aunt sort of threw her off a bit, right? It was a trick. I said, "Well, Aunt Annie, just trying to be like Jesus." "Oh, I know you'd say that," she said. Word from our sponsor. I work a little bit with MCC as what's called the church relations person, trying to enhance MCC's work with and through the churches. And so I'm sort of a PR kind of person, a spy trying to break into churches that don't want to work with MCC necessarily, and then get back to MCC and say, you know, we need to smarten up a little bit in order that churches will want to work with us. So I'm in trouble on both sides, so I'm quite happy most of the time. Jennifer Mapungu, who works with our refugee program, and Amaya, she busy these days, asked me to say to the churches when I go to them, please remember, as incredible as it is, and I think there's a group of you working and you as a church are helping to sponsor a refugee family, she said, please remind people in the churches that this is a classic biblical story, this refugee story, insofar that only one in 99 is coming. The other 99 who should be getting out of Syria and other horrible places in the world at this point can't and won't. And a lot of the MCC work that we do continues to support the 99 that won't get here or other places of safety. So let's not forget to pray for and to support the other programs, whether that's Global Families or other things that MCC does with its partners. I made a trip to Ethiopia with MCC and visited our partner there. Our biggest partner in Ethiopia is the Mezreti Christos Church, which is actually a Mennonite Anabaptist church with 277,000 members. Hugest Anabaptist Mennonite group in the world. They were only 5,000 when the communists took over the country of Addis after the death of Haile Selassie, or the overthrow. And the communist people or leaders took the church buildings away and imprisoned their pastors. The church went underground. And when 19 years later the communists were pushed out, the church had grown from 5,000 to 50,000. Amazing story. We visited one of their sites where they were very busy together. The church has a relief and development wing to it. They had done a huge land reclamation project helping farmers and with the farmers' families in a very, very poor area with education programs. And we asked the young leader of that program, were there any surprises? He got this big smile on his face, and he said, "While we reclaimed all these acres of land and we put together a food bank and seed bank and educational programs, 11 churches were planted." And so there's all sorts of work that's going, and so I'm really proud to represent MCC because we are the hands and feet of Christ in ways that are incredible. We visited one of the churches on Sunday morning, huge building. The music started, people were filling the room, the music started, the worship team came in with their long robes on, but jumped up and like down like rock singers, and they sang a congregational song. One song, worship team, 45 minutes. I didn't count, but about 108 verses. So if you sometimes, some of you think that contemporary music repeats itself too much, do not go to Ethiopia. But in that time, people were lamenting. Many of them were lying on the floor. At other times, they were ululating, and they were celebrating. They were standing on the pews. And so throughout the song, it rose and fell, and they sort of celebrated all the emotions of the psalmists through the singing of one song. Finally, out of fatigue, I guess, they sat down, and a soloist got up, and she sang for 25 minutes, one song as well. We had to leave before the sermon started. It might still be going. But what an encouragement to be there. As I was leaving, a woman all dressed up in this incredible African garb, bright high hat and flowing robes, she grabbed me by the hand and asked where I was from, and I said I was from Canada. She said, "Oh, you're rich." And I said, "No, not as rich as my relatives." But she said, "I want you to take a message back to your people in Canada." She said, "We have a perception that you are rich, and you will have comments on that." She says, "But compared to us, you are very, very wealthy in a material sort of way." She said, "Go back to your people and please take this message to them. Tell them to pray for hardship. Tell them to pray that they might lose everything. Because I believe that people who are wealthy and well lose the ability to see Jesus." So I said, "I will tell that message. I don't know whether I want to believe it, but I hear what you say." So very encouraging and yet inspiring things. So bless God. Thank God for the work of MCC. And it really is the church at work. Messy Christmas, the unsilent night. In my first year as a pastor, I began to realize that many people in the church, in the congregation I was serving then in Winnipeg, did not think of Christmas the way I thought of it. I had always assumed that Christmas was just the way I had experienced it. Family, friends, cousins, Christmas concerts, intertwining stories of baby Jesus and jolly old St. Nick, a new toy truck or a toboggan, board games, jelly candies, turkey, peanuts, skating on a frozen slough, digging snow caves into a snowbank, and on. But of course, over time, pastoring again over 30 years, I found out that Christmas is a mixed emotion for almost all of us. Christmas has taught me that we cannot dress it necessarily in warm, fuzzy feelings. But what is really fascinating to me that Christmas, the idea of Christmas, is always wrapped around the idea of family. And so when people talk about Christmas, those who have a positive feeling about it or emotion or memories, they think of the family times. The people who have the hurtful memories think about the lack of family times or the hurtful family times, the drunkenness, the fighting, the arguing, or the absence of. And almost every description that I've heard in these years about Christmas, its anticipation and its emotion is about either family plus or family negative. So Christmas somehow in our heads is wrapped around the idea of family. And what's interesting about the family concept for us is that the first Christmas family are the ones that started that concept. It was built, the story was started around family, and so it continues. So before I tell a couple of stories and open up today's chosen biblical text for consideration, I'd like to introduce another word. And we heard something about that already this morning in our worship and conversation. Yesterday, I read this in the New York Times. Americans are more fearful about the likelihood of another terrorist attack than at any other time after the weeks of September 11th, 2001. And a growing sense of dread has helped lift Donald Trump to a new high among Republican primary voters. Fear reigns in our world today, from Syria to Paris, from New York to San Bernardino, from Richmond to Coquitlam. Many in the world have known that it is a mess, but in our part of the world, we have come to expect that the norm to life on earth is success, safety, peace, levels of entitlement, and wealth. Suddenly, though, we have found our world is shrinking and sinking, and the general messiness of the wider world seems to be spreading out and coming our way in awarenesses. And I'm guessing that never have we been that aware of it, even here in our relatively easy West world. The world is horribly messy. The lady of the Statue of Liberty in the harbor of New York, you can have a picture of it with the green light on it, has been known to have this plaque on it. It doesn't really have this on the plaque, but next to it, it says, "Give me your tired, your poor, your huddled masses yearning to breathe free, the wretched refuse of your teeming shore. Send these, the homeless, the tempest tossed to me, and I will lift the lamp beside the golden door. The words, the sentiment of the Statue of Liberty. Fascinating for me, and you can argue with me about this if you like. Ironically, on at least two counts, it was the president of the Liberty College who this week encouraged his Bible students to begin carrying guns. Statue of Liberty, Liberty College, held in contrast. It's a messy world, people. I think Pastor Dave has a lot of courage to call his Advent series Messy Christmas. We kind of like to forget how tough things are every once in a while. And I applaud him for that. Not because it isn't real, it is real, but because if we don't address what's real, we get caught up in the backspin of denial and untold nonsense consequences. There are always calls to just forget about the bad for a moment. And today, let's have a good time, we hear. Well, there is a time for everything. We know that from the Bible. But we need an authentic and honest way to get to what is truly good. And it's through the bad, not around it. Jesus modeled that for us. We don't get to the good by going around the bad. We have to go through it. Let me move towards a point I'd like to make today, beginning with a couple of stories and end with that biblical text, as I said, to ensure we know what the real point of the Jesus story is for this season. When my wife and I were newlyweds, we traveled through Europe, began to run out of money, no surprise, didn't want to come home, and had heard from other people on the road that one could go and live in Israel on a kibbutz, a communal farm, and it wouldn't cost anything. They provided you with everything you needed and maybe $15 or $20 a month, and you could live there happily ever after. So we boarded a plane in Switzerland and flew to Israel and found our way to a kibbutz just a few miles from the south end of the Sea of Galilee. We worked there as what we called volunteers. There were about 30 of us from various countries in the world in a population of 600 on this communal farm. We started on December 1st. On the 23rd of December, they announced at the 6 o'clock breakfast where we all gathered to get our work details for the day that there would be a special trip for those who were interested to Bethlehem for the big celebration. They can't say the word Christmas. So we were curious about that, and they announced then later in the day that anybody that wanted to go to Bethlehem should show up on the 24th at 4 o'clock at the dining hall. At 4:30, a truck pulled up. A banana truck. One of the things we harvested on the kibbutz were bananas. And we harvested these big bunches of bananas, 60, 70 pounds of them, and would load them on the back of the trucks, and they'd be hauled off to market. This banana truck pulled up with little seats sort of along the side and down the middle and a tarp over the top and said, "Here's your ride to Bethlehem." So we crawled in. We filled the back of the truck, and somebody pulled the tarp over the top. The floor was slippery, of course, and very stinky. Somebody said, "We must be bananas going on this trip." Was about a 3.5, 4-hour drive through the down the West Bank, through Jericho, up to Jerusalem, and then 6 miles south to Bethlehem. And we traveled, and we sang, and we shivered, and we were cold. And some non-Mennonite in the group pulled out a bottle of Iraq clear liquor that was handed around. And I was told that drinking that stuff was like swallowing a lit fluorescent bulb. And that's how we traveled. The truck stopped. We heard shouting, and the tarp was pulled off from the back, from the outside, and the muzzles of two M16 machine guns came in at us over flashlights, and we had these young Israeli soldiers saying, "Shalom." We crawled out of the truck, jumped down. It was rainy, it was sort of foggy, and we could see. We were now that Bethlehem was up on the hill, about maybe a mile away, and over the hills and around us, bonfires this way, bonfires this way, and we were told that Israeli soldiers, man to man, were completely surrounded the city of Bethlehem for Christmas Eve. And we had heard the announcement that some of the more radical groups from the fundamentalist Islamic groups then, and I'm always nervous about saying that at this point, but that's how they described themselves, said that we were not to go to Bethlehem. They would ensure that something terrible would happen. So against those warnings, we went, and the soldiers were there, and we jumped off as we were jumping off the truck. Somebody remarked how ironic it was on Christmas Eve that there were Jewish soldiers protecting Christian pilgrims from Islamic fundamentalist exceptional groups. We walked up into Jerusalem, or up into Bethlehem, the square Bethlehem. If you've been at Bethlehem, there's a big square right next to the Church of the Nativity. Lots of businesses going. Of course, Christmas Eve is the biggest night. A bunch of choirs were singing. People were dancing, singing, visiting. We were all being frisked constantly wherever we went to make sure we weren't carrying explosives and so on and so forth, waiting to get into the church. The church is shared by three major denominations, and we couldn't get into the service because we didn't have letters from our priests, not having priests, so we were just left on the outside until we could get in later on. So while we were standing and listening to the music and part of the celebration and watching the dancing young men, there were some very drunken young men, and somebody came and apologized to us and said, sorry for the bad behavior, but it's Christmas Eve and they're Christians. Unsilent night. We finally got into the church, and you wander through the big basilica, and there's a stairway down into the spot where they believe the stable was. There isn't a lot of argument about a lot of holy sites. There is argued about in Bethlehem and other parts of it. But there's a site below the altar of the church, probably 20 feet deeper than the main floor, where there's a silver star embedded into the marble floor, which apparently marks the spot where Christ was born. And people march through. You come down one little set of steps, you walk by. Everybody's given a moment to reach down. The Orthodox and Greek Orthodox especially will bend over and they'll kiss the spot, and people will cry. And if it's not too crowded, we'll sing a little carol there, but the priests keep us moving. And so we came down, and it was emotional, and it's kind of garish, and there's candles and there's incense burners, and it's very high churchy in that sense, but it was moving for us to be there. And just as I came to the silver star, someone said, "Look, there's Cat Stevens." Those of you my age know who Cat Stevens was. He was a rock star, right? And I was just stunned that all of us who were looking at the Christ star turned to look at the rock star. My, oh my, do we need some peace tonight? And we moved back into the city and were part of the celebration, and was just stunned to observe how unsilent Bethlehem was on Christmas night. And as the bomb squad came in to pick up a knapsack that somebody had left unattended, a choir from Philadelphia was singing, "Oh, Holy Night, what a mess, messy Christmas." Back in 2009, after another trip to the Holy Land, my wife and my daughter and her husband came and joined me, and we traveled by van from Israel, Eilat, southern Israel, across the desert to Cairo. This was just a year or maybe 2 years before the latest uprising started up, but they were well being fomented and started by that time. Across the desert, in a trip that I was the only time I've really been sure I was going to die in the next minute, this man drove beyond crazy. We were stopped 7 to 9 times at border checks, where from 5 to 10 soldiers would check our little visas, which had been written up by our guide on a piece of paper, writing down the number of our passports and so much, just on fragments of paper, to check whether we were legit and whether we were arriving at the checkpoints at the set time. And they were on phones with one another, and we were told we had a driver, a guide, and a policeman, a tourist policeman, with just the four of us. If we'd have been 20 minutes late, they would have sent out the army to look for us. We made it to Cairo. We're put in a nice hotel, and we're toured around during the day by a Muslim guide who was fantastic. But we were told not to leave the hotel at night. Whenever it was dark, in fact, we had to stay in. And during the day, we visited, apparently traditionally believed, the site where the Holy Family went, when Mary and Joseph, baby Jesus, went to Egypt. We're going to read that text in here. This church, again, is built over a site that's down in the basement that marks the spot. And the Coptic Christians venerate the spot. And it's a place to remember the story. What was interesting by that time already, the streets around the church were already blocked by soldiers. Only Christians were allowed in because there was a huge threat that the church would be about to be blown up. And the Egyptian soldiers protecting that church to keep it from being blown up and to make sure the tourists were safe, because the Egyptian government doesn't want too many tourists to be bothered, because then they'll stop spending their money. They were behind big metal shields where they had their guns through the little space in it and were protecting us from what might happen in this unsilent, messy Christian site. We live in a messy world, and silent night is a dream. Let's read the text, this. Matthew 2, verse 13. When they had gone, an angel of the Lord appeared to Joseph in a dream. When whose they had gone? When the three wise men had left, because they had, of course, made a connection with the king Herod, that they would tell him about who this king was that they had come to visit. When they had gone, an angel of the Lord appeared to Joseph in a dream. "Get up," he said, "take the child and his mother and escape to Egypt, where it's safe, where it's silent. Stay there until I tell you, for Herod is going to search for the child to kill him. So he got up, took the child and his mother during the night, and left for Egypt during the night. Notice the words and the ideas. Where he stayed until the death of Herod, and so was fulfilled what the Lord had said through the prophet, out of Egypt I called my son. When Herod realized that he had been outwitted by the Magi, he was furious, and he gave orders to kill all the boys in Bethlehem and its vicinity who were 2 years old and under, in accordance with the time he had learned from the Magi. Then what was said through the prophet Jeremiah was fulfilled. A voice is heard in Ramah, weeping and great mourning. Rachel, Rachel, weeping for her children and refusing to be comforted because they are no more. Just for a minute here, I'd like you to shout out a word or a phrase that comes up as you hear the text, and many of you have heard it many times. What words that describe emotion or word pictures come up when you see or hear that text? Hunting for a child, fear, enormous fear. Anything else? Death, darkness, right? Extreme darkness. Intervention, spiritual intervention, yes. Anything else? Panic. In the middle of the night, no lights, no taxi, up and out. Fear, corrupt and dangerous power, threatened and real violence. Refugees, and in the text, in the Jeremiah text, referring to another time, mourning, loss, and the whole text is rife with fear. What was world like when Jesus was born into it 2,000 years ago? It was a messy world. How would we guess the people of the day would have described their world? They would have described it as messy and dangerous. Has nothing changed? We live in a messy world, and Christmas continues to occur on an unsilent night. But when we turn the pages of the story, the gospel story, right back to the prophets anticipating the Christ story, of Jesus coming to and during his sojourn on earth, what do we hear? What's in between in the lines? And I'm always trying to read the Bible and understand what's between the lines. Well, what is in that whole story from beginning to end, which is still in process? Well, Zechariah hears, do not be afraid. Elizabeth hears, do not be afraid. Mary hears, do not be afraid. Joseph hears, do not be afraid. The shepherds hear, do not be afraid. Years later, Jesus says to his followers over and over and over and over and over again, do not be afraid. Let not your hearts be troubled. Do not be afraid. And the women who were crying after Jesus when the tomb was empty, they hear, do not be afraid. The assembled people in the room, terrified with Christ's crucifixion, they hear, do not be afraid. And the Apostle Paul heard, do not be afraid. And then the Apostle Paul said it, do not be afraid. And then John in the book of Revelation says to us, do not be afraid. Over and over and over and over again. For those of us following Jesus, and those who would just do the same, it hasn't ended. The Bible, the still small voice of the Spirit of the universe, keeps saying over and over and over and over again, do not be afraid. Do not be afraid. It might be said that no call, no message is more often repeated in the story of Jesus than do not be afraid. God knew we were going to be standing here today fighting back fear. And what's more, the world that he was born into, lived in, and was targeted in for assassination. Can you imagine under 2 years old and already targeted for assassination? Was a refugee in and was homeless in a messy, messy world. No less than today's world. The guns are bigger. The danger is the same. So what's the point of the Christmas story? Yes, it's a messy world, and tonight and every night is an unsilent night in this world, even Christmas Eve, even in Bethlehem. But don't be afraid. Don't be afraid. Marilynne Robinson, American novelist and essayist, wrote in September in the New York Review of Books this. Listen to this. Fear is not a Christian habit of mind. Isn't that remarkable? I needed to hear that. Fear is not a Christian habit of mind. As children, we learn to say, yea, though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I will fear no evil, for thou art with me. We learn that after his resurrection, Jesus told his disciples, "Lo, I am with you always to the close of the age." Christ is a gracious, abiding presence in all reality, and in him history will finally be resolved. Fear isn't easy to dispel. We can't just jettison it and get rid of it because someone says, "Oh, don't be afraid. Don't worry about it. Oh yeah, okay, turn it off." It's not the way our emotions work. But what we can do is seek to focus on the idea of not being afraid rather than that which frightens us. Pray that we do not be so afraid and that we will keep our eyes on Jesus. We will cling to Jesus. We will walk with Jesus. We will let Jesus hold us. We will let him tweak our anxiety, calm our shaking hands, and set us free. I have a couple of images of Jesus to end that I often go to. The first being one out of my memory of my children when they were young. When I would spend many early mornings jogging in the rain of a Richmond winter, and I would say and I would pray and I would imagine, and I would say these words, "Jesus, hold the hand of my 8-year-old daughter, Shoshana, while balancing my 5-year-old Ayla on your shoulders, and as you are pulling my 2-year-old son Levi sitting in his wagon on the way up to Jerusalem, the city of their peace, and bring along all their friends and all our enemies." The second is that I imagine Jesus taking each and every one of us, taking our faces into his hands like this, and looking deeply into our eyes, yours and mine, saying this, "You are precious to me. You are precious to me. You do not need to be afraid. The night is unsilent, yes. Doesn't matter right now. The world is messy, yes, but I am here. Come with me. Believe in me. Follow me. Give me your heart. Take my hand. And I will be with you always, because I am the Prince of Peace, the bringer of shalom." And what is shalom? Shalom is a place, a state, an existence that is a forever all rights.